Harvard's president, Drew Faust, described Catherine Schultz's book, Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margins of Error, as the one book she wished every Harvard freshman would read. This wonderful book about human fallibility has helped me accept my own past disasters, my present shortcomings, and my innumerable and inevitable future mistakes. Why do we go through life thinking we need to be right about everything, from how to run the country to how to run the dishwasher? Why, if being wrong about a lot of stuff is completely natural, inevitable, and universal, why are we all so bad at imagining that our own ideas, facts, and beliefs might be mistaken? Why do we typically react to evidence of our errors with surprise, denial, defensiveness, and shame? Well, bad things happen to those who are found out to be wrong. From when we're small, we learn that getting things wrong means something is very wrong with us. That making an awful mistake means we're an awful person. Consider how cruelly many parents and even whole cultures sometimes punish their errant children. Think how unkindly we treat our two fallible celebrities and felons, whose whole lives and futures we judge and decide based on their very worst moments and decisions. The concepts behind right and wrong don't seem at all absolute to me. It's obvious to me that every child's conscience, values, and beliefs develop uniquely relative to her personal experiences, her culture, and her unique upbringing. Furthermore, simplistic, memorizable lists of moral maxims rarely completely untangle any complicated ethical disagreements to the equal satisfaction of all concerned. Think of the Middle East. I can still hear my mother's voice saying, "Don't you know right from wrong yet?" No, Mom, I don't. Not in any absolute sense. I do have my own acquired set of refined ethical values. We all do. But none of us has yet quite convinced everyone else on the planet that we're absolutely right about all of them. People do like to feel certain, though, even while we find the certainties of others totally irritating, especially the stuff we disagree with, whether changing the climate or changing the thermostat. Our own equally obnoxious certainties we experience as what? Why, clear evidence of our own rightness. People with opposing views, we think of them as ignorant of the facts, stupid, as in too stupid to understand the facts, or sometimes just plain evil. Stupid, ignorant, evil. These are fairly harsh labels to attach to the people we merely disagree with, which begins to explain our own strong preferences for not wanting to be wrong. But coming from being right about everything doesn't work. whether it's about contested facts, or who's telling the truth, or about who the bad guys are, who started it, who's at fault, what happened, who meant well and who didn't, who did what to whom, or whose ideology or philosophy or government or religion or party or plan or ethnicity or nation is right. Insisting on being right just doesn't help human communications. Doesn't make relationships or situations better. Doesn't resolve conflicts amicably. The Buddhist tradition encourages us to let go of our judgments and stop labeling our experiences so sternly as good, bad, right, wrong. It's all just reality. And when we stop condemning everything, stop clinging so earnestly to feeling right, stop pushing away our uncomfortable feelings of wrongness, we can avoid a lot of optional, personal and global suffering. Maybe we could just stop using the words right and wrong altogether. Humankind's greatest inspirational examples repeatedly urge us to judge not. Pope Francis said recently in answer to a question about gay priests, "Who am I to judge?" Our own Unitarian Universalism encourages us to accept difference, avoid judgment, and treat the broad diversity of opinions and cultures respectfully and compassionately. I still find it excruciating to say, I was wrong, and leave it at that. Feeling wrong is hard, humbling, even dangerous, like being flayed and laid out before the world. Whenever I'm clearly mistaken, I cringe with embarrassment and frustration, still believing, foolishly, that I ought always to be right, that is, both correct and good. I always want to add something to my apologies, to explain away my mistakes so they won't feel like mistakes anymore, to say, I was almost right, or I was wrong for the right reasons, or not really so right, so I'm not really so very wrong after all. I'm hoping to morph my mistakes into non-mistakes. But those very feelings of defensiveness are my loudest and clearest signal that once again I've bought into an illusion. The illusion that somehow, some way, I can avoid making mistakes. In the end, feeling wrong is what makes real growth possible. Feeling wrong is a psychological construction site. All pits and wrecking balls and cranes, the place where we destroy and rebuild ourselves, where all the ground gives way and all the ladders start. Catherine Schultz explains how humans evolved and refined our unique capacity to imagine and hypothesize to become the theorizing species, the inventive, creative, playful, artistic, scientific, witty, adventurous, spiritual species. Unfortunately for us, this same highly refined imaginative capacity also makes us the mistake-making species. More than any other animal, we humans guess. And it is this very capacity for creative guesswork that makes our projecting, predicting, and policy making possible, that takes us boldly where no one has gone before, and that takes us into wrongness. By the way, I'm right about all this stuff. Well, I could be wrong, but never Reverend Carl. I do think he knows everything. But I could be wrong. None of us can afford to wait, however, till we're sure we're right about everything before we speak out, before we take action. It's only when we overcome our fears of making mistakes, being wrong, we summon our moral courage, bravely articulate our thoughtfully weighed, unique perspectives, share our personal visions, contribute our authentic voices to the planetary dialogue, and take bold action that our ideas will finally take form and our hopes take wing. The best part of being a guessing, theorizing, and erring species is that we're free to wander into error. And wandering is the way we discover the world and ourselves. In a sense, says Catherine Schultz, all wrongness is optimism. We delight in believing that this time we will succeed, where in the past we have failed, or failed to try. Believing the best of ourselves, even when we're intimately familiar with the worst and the merely average. Believing that everything in us that is well-intentioned will triumph over all that is lazy or fickle or indifferent or unkind. Wrongness, as optimism, is an endlessly renewable faith in our own potential. Wrongness gets us started and keeps us going. Take away our willingness to overestimate ourselves, we wouldn't dare undertake half the things we do. Ultimately, no matter how often we bumbling humans get things wrong, progress depends upon having an abiding and touching faith in our own stories and theories. And that is why error, even though it sometimes feels like despair, is actually much closer in spirit to hope.
One famous definition of faith from the Christian tradition comes from Hebrews 11:1, that faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things unseen. Etymologically, the root of the word faith is related to our word for trust. Faith trusts that something is or will be the case, even though there is not verifiable proof. In many cases, the evidence for faith-based claims is internal. It is subjective. It is based on something that's unpredictable, as opposed to something that's external and more objective and something that's more easily replicatable in laboratory conditions. Now, being internal and subjective and unpredictable doesn't make something less true, necessarily. As the saying goes, it only takes one white crow to prove that not all crows are black. But it does mean that faith claims are difficult, often, if not impossible, to either prove or disprove according to the scientific method. The rub, however, from our perspective here in the early 21st century, is that we are almost 500 years into the scientific revolution. In 1543, Nicholas Copernicus's book on the revolutions of the heavenly spheres shattered the Ptolemaic view of the universe, which had reigned for millennia. The Ptolemaic view was that we live in a three-tiered universe, that literally heaven is up and literally hell is down, and that we humans are here right at the center of life, the universe, and everything. But the Copernican revolution showed that it was the sun and not the earth that was the center of our solar system, and that began to decenter our place, or our lack thereof, in the grand scheme of things. And that decentering has only become increasingly clear with the paradigm-shifting discoveries from Darwin to Freud to Einstein to Hubble that followed Copernicus. Some of you may recall when the self-proclaimed evolutionary evangelist Michael Dowd preached here at UUCF back in 2014. His sermon was called Factual Faith, Religion as If Survival Mattered. Dowd likes to contrast a flat earth faith with an evolutionary faith. And for Dowd, the problem with flat earth faith is that it is B.C., not before Christ, but before Copernicus. At the same time, that doesn't mean that we have to throw out all of that BC before Copernicus material. As I say each Sunday, here we seek to draw wisdom from all the world's religions, but we seek to balance it with the insights of modern science. There remain many compelling reasons to take ancient theologies seriously, metaphorically, archetypally, but we go dangerously awry when we take those before Copernicus flat earth metaphors literally. Indeed, the 20th century theologian Dorothy Sollier has pointed out that faith without doubt is not stronger, it's merely more ideological. Faith without doubt is not stronger, it is merely more ideological, meaning that there's some idea at the center that's presupposed and can't be questioned and just keeps being asserted. And there are daily examples in the news of ideological leaders who refuse to change their minds despite stacks of evidence that just keep growing, contradicting their positions. Along these lines, Anne Lamott has written that the opposite of faith is not doubt, it is certainty, and that is madness. You can tell you have created God in your image when it turns out that God conveniently hates all the same people that you do. Stephen Colbert calls this phenomenon truthiness, right? I can't prove it, but it just feels right, right? Feels true. And as a result, many people presenting truthy claims take these false talking points and just repeat them over and over until many people are manipulated into believing this misinformation. This tactic is not new. Ancient Athenian democracy gives us the word demagoguery for politicians who appeal to emotions, to fears, to prejudices and ignorances to gain power and to promote their political positions and increase their power. To relate ideology and demagoguery and truthiness back to our commitment to evolutionary religion, one that embraces all that we have learned since the scientific revolution, it has been said that the liberal turn in religion, and hear that word liberal correctly, that's classic liberalism from the Latin word liber, meaning free. So liberal religion means free religion. That the liberal turn in religion is an attempt to create meaningful lives and to build beloved communities in a world that is diverse and in which the traditional center has fallen out. It is a shift from authority that is grounded in community and hierarchy and tradition to authority grounded in reason, in what is logical, and authority grounded in experience. What one either knows internally and subjectively for oneself and one's own firsthand experience, or grounded in what one it can experientially prove through empirically through the scientific method. Accordingly, what I mean when my sermon title, The Spirituality of Doubt, is a skepticism toward secondhand claims that you should believe or do something simply because it is traditional, right? They say the seven last words of the church are, we've always done it that way. And we should also have skepticism, you know, because you shouldn't do something just because an authority figure tells you to, right? Except for me, right? I don't have to worry about that. I've been here long enough to know that. And also, the spirituality of doubt is about a growing demand to test the validity of any claim about what is meaningful or sacred in the crucible of one's own firsthand experience. The bumper sticker version of this is something like, you may have seen something along these lines, that religion is for people who are scared of going to hell, and spirituality is for people who have been through hell already, right here on this earth. And that in many ways, I think that Unitarian Universalism is a real attempt to institutionalize the possibility of being spiritual and religious together, and saying that we don't have to go through this alone. We can accompany one another on this journey, on our journeys through this life. So looking to the growing edge of doubt today, there is, in all seriousness, a very interesting emerging field of studies called ignorance studies. And more formally, it's called agnotology. So think about that word agnostic, right? So we have knowledge, right? We spell knowledge with a K because the Greeks had gnosis. So the Greek word for knowledge is gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S. And so an agnostic is someone, you add A in Greek, right, to cancel it out. So like an atheist, you have an A gnosis. So agnostic or agnotology is the, it is, and it's both, so it's not like, so this is really getting nerdy, briefly, I know. Anyway, it's different from what we sometimes call in philosophy epistemology, right, which is the study of knowledge. Agnotology is not just the study of knowledge, and it's not just studying what we don't know and why we don't know it. It's actually way more interesting than that, because agnotology is particularly interested in what keeps ignorance alive, and what also allows ignorance to be used as a political instrument. As the X-Files tells us, the truth is out there, but there are also things that people don't want you to know. Perhaps the most dangerous example today is climate change denial. However, another example from recent history that agnotologists are very interested in because of the parallels to today is the tobacco industry's spin on saying, we're just not sure about that whole cigarettes causing cancer thing, right? How long did that go on? And so that's a prime example of agnotology. So as explored in a recent article in the New York Times titled The Case for Teaching Ignorance, there can be a lot of virtue in confessing how much we don't know, because uncertainty can foster latent curiosity. When you name what we don't know, it can inspire people to say, well, I'm going to go find out or try to, while overemphasizing clarity, on the other hand, can warp our perceptions of what we know. To take an example from the medical field, a commonly assigned urology textbook is 1,414 pages. That could mislead a student into thinking that we know far more about the brain than we actually know. Because even if we know hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages about the brain, there's still so much more about the brain that we're just starting to learn, not to mention the, you know, headache-inducing problem of using the brain to study the brain, right? That start thinking about that and you'll have to lay down for a while. Moreover, to summarize a point made in Thomas Kuhn's extremely important landmark book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, the more we know, what really happens is the more we can ask. And that questions don't give way to answers so much as the two proliferate together. As the poet Rilke wrote, love the questions, learn to live the questions. In contrast, the history of Western civilization has in many ways been biased toward faith and belief over skepticism and doubt. As a counterbalance, the historian Jennifer Michael Hecht has written an excellent volume titled Doubt, A History, in which she traces the great doubters throughout the ages and across the globe. And that scale of doubt quiz on the front of your order of service is excerpted from that volume. And in a world where faith and belief are often the norm, I feel like I should stop at this point and qualify that classic 90s qualification of not that there's anything wrong with that, right? We're a big tent religion. There is room for faith and doubt as well as for skepticism and disbelief. But Hecht's goal in a world, in the Western world that has been biased toward faith and belief is to invite us to take a step back and to reflect on what we believe or disbelieve and why, though it can be disconcerting to all of a sudden see the framework flipped in favor of doubt as normative. Regarding her motivation for writing A World History of Doubt, Hecht writes, "The only thing that she saw that doubters really needed today, that believers already have, is a sense that people like themselves have always been around, that they are part of a grand history." And in her research, she discovered throughout history, there have been saints of doubt, martyrs of atheism, and sages of happy disbelief, which date to as early as the skepticism of the pre-Socratic philosophers, as well as the Athenian gadfly himself, Socrates, who taught that wisdom was often not so much what you know or what you think you know, but being really clear and being really aware of what you don't know. There's also strong doubt and skepticism in the Jewish and Christian traditions, particularly in the books of Job and Ecclesiastes, but perhaps the most helpful part of a global survey of doubt is a reminder that in contrast to the history of Western civilization, in the East, the question of the existence of God has rarely been a central question, and there are prominent Eastern traditions in which doubt is revered. Most prominently in Zen Buddhism, there is a famous saying that is, "Great doubt, great awakening. Little doubt, little awakening. No doubt, no awakening." That Zen saying is quite a contrast to where we started, with faith as the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. Indeed, Jennifer Michael Hecht traces what she calls the great schism between those believers and doubters who find themselves on opposite ends of her scale of doubt. She writes, "Great doubters, like great believers, have been people occupied with the problem of trying to figure out whether the universe has a hidden version of humanness." So that great doubters and great believers have been occupied with the problem of trying to figure out whether the universe has a hidden version of humanness. Whether humanness is the error and people are better off weaning themselves from their sense of narrative and justice and love and thereby solving the schism by becoming more like this universe in which we are all stuck. Now, I'm not going to attempt to resolve that schism this morning, but wherever you find yourself on that spectrum of faith and doubt, I would like to leave you with two quotes this morning. The first is from the philosopher Peter Rollins, a self-proclaimed practitioner of pyrotheology, which he describes as an incendiary faith that courageously embraces brokenness, that resolutely faces up to unknowing, and that joyfully accepts the difficulty of our existence. And regarding what Hecht calls that great schism, Rollins writes that the individual that is able to loose themselves from the notion that there is some sort of ultimate purpose, capital U, capital P, for their lives. So if you're able to free yourself from that notion of there being an ultimate purpose, capital U, capital P, you might free yourself both from the negative melancholy that comes from being unable to find that ultimate purpose, or the naive optimism that comes from thinking that you will. The secret, Rollins writes, is that there is no secret. Instead, the challenge is to discover and deepen love. For love not only affirms this world, it produces a surplus in that joyful affirmation, acts that enact liberation. So regarding how a spirituality of doubt can ironically produce a world-affirming love, so saying we can't know some ultimate purpose, but what we can do is love right here and now. We know we can do that. And it can also produce liberating acts, saying that there, once we're freed from false restrictions, we can do what we know we're able to do for the people and places around us. So in that spirit, I invite you to hear a poem that I first read a few months ago from Yehuda Amichai, who's the probably most famous 20th century poet of Israel. It's called From the Place Where We Are Right. And it's about how doubt, including self-doubt, can open us to new possibilities. So you can think along the lines of some of what Nancy mentioned earlier about being willing to be wrong. Amichai writes that from the place where we are right, from the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. Think what that would be like. It's just winter all the time, right? If we just insist that we are right, it will be winter all the time. That is the subtext of Amichai's poem. From the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring, because from the place where we are right is hard, and it is trampled like a yard. But doubts and love dig up the world like a mole, like a plow, and a whisper will be heard where the ruined house once stood. And hear that poem too as arising very much existentially out of the ongoing Palestinian-Israel crisis, where you have two sides convinced that they are right. I'll leave you with one final thought. The Sufi poet Jalal al-Din Rumi has a very short poem where he says, out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing. So think of all those things that you heard in Nancy's sermon. So out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. So think about what that might mean in the coming days and weeks for the people that you encounter to say, and especially as we enter into a political season, right? Out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a place. I'll meet you there. That what might it look like for your authentic self to encounter and be vulnerable to their authentic self, to who they really are, not your idea of them, not just their ideas intellectually, but really to be present to that other human being in front of you? What might that look like?